This talk by Bishop Peter Brain is entitled Challenges Facing the Anglican Church in Australia. It was given at an EFAC meeting in Perth on the 12th of March 2012. It has been edited by the removal of inaudible questions and discussion.
Well, folks, thanks, Peter, for your welcome. Just terrific to see old faces and some new ones as well. I don't recall an EFAC meeting with this many people at it 12 years ago. So it's really great to be with you. And thanks for asking me to share with you. I think it's called, what I've written down is Challenges Facing the Anglican Church in Australia. Is that what you wanted me to do? Something like that. All right. Well, it's a joy to be back. Chris and I are living down in Wellard. We've been here 2 weeks. I finished my workbench this afternoon, which means the garage will be tidied. And I think the last box unpacked. Christine's a long way ahead of me. The house is packed and it's sorted, but I'm still not quite sorted.
Still got wheels on the car.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah. So thank you indeed. I didn't expect to be able to even be at a meeting like this so early in the time we're here. How long do you want me to speak for? I understand you want the question.
Our meeting begins at 11 o'clock.
All right. Certainly be finished by then. Okay, well, I thought I'd just make my comments in four areas. Firstly, some general comments about Australian culture. There's terrific challenges there. Then I thought that I'd talk about some of the challenges that we bring as pastors. And then just a short thing about our strengths as Anglicans, and then to speak about challenges to us as evangelicals in particular. I was taken about 3 months ago by a comment that Harry Goodhue made. He is 81, remarkably fit, continuing to evangelise all over the place, continuing to be involved in EE. But his comment at the retreat that we had, an EFAC retreat we had late in November, was that he feels that evangelism and ministry in Australia at the moment is a little bit like ploughing concrete. Now, if that's true of the eastern states, it's got to be even more true of here, I suspect, in WA. Many of you will recall the comment that Frank Retief made. You all know who Frank Retief is. He was the presiding bishop of the Church of England in South Africa up till a few years ago, a great friend of Aussies. And this was at the 100th anniversary of the Katoomba Christian Conventions. They had a preaching school. And his comment was, just a throwaway line, I understand, I wasn't there. Kaneshka may have been there, I don't know. About 5 years ago. And his comment was, I pray that my adult children will not emigrate to Australia. In South Africa, the worst thing that can happen to them is they get shot. In Australia, they lose their faith. I met some South Africans at church yesterday, a South African man who was making almost exactly the same noises. It seemed like a good thing to emigrate to Australia, but to see the rampage of materialism. Now, I've always thought South Africans were pretty materialistic, but both those comments seem to me to help us to see that that's an ongoing enormous challenge for us as Christians. I think what it's led to, certainly amongst us Aussies, but also amongst us Aussie Christians, is a low tolerance for hardship. A very low tolerance for hardship. I can say it here because none of you have done it. But it's not uncommon for me to turn up to clergy meetings over in the eastern states, and clergy will be bringing in their purchased coffee from the local dome or whatever, rather than share the coffee there. And people make smart comments about it, it builds a gap. That's an evidence of low tolerance, in my judgment. Certainly low tolerance for commitment amongst Christian people. And so there's a general robbing, I think, of ourselves of the joy of service. Remember that great line in the morning prayer, whose service is? Perfect freedom. Now, the opportunity, of course, of that challenge, it seems to me, is for us as Christians to be able to tap into the unhappiness that all of that is causing. And the law of diminishing returns, of course, quickly sets in when that happens. Who was the fellow who wrote The Eagle Has Landed? Yeah, I remember reading about him saying, I wish somebody had told me that it's as lonely on the top of the pile as it was on the bottom. And I guess that's the terrific challenge for us and the loneliness that comes. The other challenge, of course, it seems to me, for us as Christians, is to be able to build robust and what I call non-needy sacrificial disciples who can actually tap in to those people when they come to our congregations. It's a challenge to us as pastors, it seems to me, to be an example without complaining, without counting the cost and what I've come to see and call ministerial preciousness, which can very easily creep into us as pastors. So that's the first challenge in terms of the Australian culture. The second one, I think, for us as pastors in general is, and I've seen it now, I was trying to work it out on the train coming down, just going through the names of American models that came across our path, going back to Frank Tiglath, was it? And then there, him. Yeah, he was big in Sydney in the late 70s, and then there was Rick Warren, and then there was Bill Hybels, and there's been lots over the years, many of whom have had terrific insights, I think, to help us with. But the propensity to ape what we saw overseas, and I think that's always on, because ministry isn't easy. Ministry seems to me to be getting harder, and often pressure can come from our congregational members, and we sort of think, well, how can we ramp things up? And the temptation often is to go for some model that is working overseas. But I just want to remind you that 75% of American churches from which most of these come from are less than 70 people in their congregations. And the other interesting thing to me is that 75% of missionary and ministry candidates come from those 75% small churches. They don't come from a big place. It's for the obvious reason that everybody's up front and the big church is paid to do it. You just don't get an opportunity to test or to do ministry in those other places. It seems to me the challenge, of course, is that it places impossible expectations and discouragement upon us. Most of us are ordinary fellows. Occasionally you get an entrepreneur who can pull off something like that in a big way. I'll never forget when Arch Hart spoke at our clergy conference about 4 years ago, and we were on our way home, and he got a text message from somebody in California, and he lives in California, urging him, could he go and visit the senior pastor of one of the top 20 churches. He'd made the leadership 20 church list, but he couldn't get out of bed that particular morning because of the expectations. Now, could Arch go and sort him out? No, it said, I can't sort him out. Can't sort him out. It's the expectations that this man's had upon him to produce something new, something big, something better for this week. I've found terrific joy over the last few years reading Tidball. Derek Tidball, His Skillful Shepherds, is his pastoral theology. And then he had a little book which I couldn't find. All my books were on the shelves, but not in order. So I couldn't find it. I actually discovered a few books I'd forgotten. That's right. But his little one called Builders and Tools, absolutely brilliant. 8 models of ministry. And the same in this one. This is a great book, I reckon, for pastors to read together. Ministry by the Book. Derek Tidball, London Bible College, Baptist pastor. He's urging us there to recognise there are many models for ministry, but urging us to move away from the entrepreneurial and the program kind of models and to remember the pastoral model that underpins most. And I guess my exhortation to my clergy certainly was, is to back yourselves in terms of a pastoral ministry. To back yourselves with pastoral ministry. Because people have needs, people want to be included, and that good old kind of style of ministry, which certainly was the thing that attracted me to the Lord, I just saw it in my leaders when I was a teenager. It was pastoral from our pastors, it was pastoral through the Sunday school teachers, it was pastoral through the youth group leaders. And it won me before I even knew it, before I even understood the gospel. So the opportunity, seems to me, in that challenge is to meet the innate longing for community that men and women have. Perth is a place of displaced people, isn't it? Well, it certainly was 12 years ago. There are 3 out of 10 people are natives, and the rest have come in from somewhere else. And that gives us terrific opportunities, it seems to me, within our churches. But once again, it means we've got to turn our people into people who are able to be givers, not getters. People who are prepared to go out of their way to welcome other people. Michael Harvey, the Back to Church Sunday man? I think it's Michael Harvey, isn't it? He's worth hearing, by the way, that man. But here's a wonderful line where he says that we need to help our church members to see themselves as hosts, not guests. And it really saddens me just to see so many people who have sat on their evangelical ministries. I've seen it in the Diocese of Armidale, you know, for 5, 10 years, and they're still acting as if they're guests. In other words, meet my needs, meet my needs, meet my needs, when they should be hosts, looking out for new people and being prepared to meet their needs, which, of course, is how their needs will be met. Acts 20:35 comes to mind. It's more blessed to give than to receive. The third area of challenge, I think, to us is to capitalise on our strengths as Anglicans. I suspect it's a bit easy for us to be a little bit apologetic for some of our strengths. And the one I mainly want to focus on is our liturgy. As Packer says in that marvellous little booklet, The Gospel and the Prayer Book, it was a response he wrote in the 60s to the new prayer books in England, and he's gone through every service and shown the gospel basis to it. And he talks about the sin, grace melody line that goes through all of our services, the occasional services and our regular ones. There's evidence all around, both from the UK and America, that the 25 to 40-year-old age group are leaving evangelical, charismatic, independent churches, non-liturgical churches, to go to liturgical churches, even the Orthodox, which is pretty barren, but it's liturgical. And I think one of the reasons for that is the sense that, well, I've been trying to work out, I think a lot of our emphasis is what I might call the IKEA. I've just put together a fair bit of IKEA furniture. The IKEA model, that is, we've become very flat in this direction. And I suspect that's one of the reasons. And I think that's going to be a challenge. And my exhortation, and our pastors had terrific, I would like to think they had terrific opportunities in terms of a liturgy. I mean, they didn't have to, I'm not talking we've got to use the book or anything like that, but to certainly use the prayers and the outline with the scripture openings, penitential, at least 2 Bible readings. Most, I don't know whether you guys have been to other churches on your holidays, but you'll rarely get a Bible reading. You might get the few verses the preacher's preaching on, but that's all you'll get. It's a great irony to me that the only Anglican churches in Australia where you don't get 4 Bible readings are evangelical ones. And you know what comes after 1 Bible reading, don't you? 0. And, I mean, that's an obvious kind of thing. But I think that's a challenge, and I know why the challenge comes, because other churches, for non-liturgical churches, don't have liturgy, and so we feel we've got to sort of ape that kind of model, but I honestly don't think it's working. I think people are looking for something that's going to take them in that direction, as well as the fellowship direction. I think the advantages, certainly for pastors, it's a realistic expectation if a congregation can recognise the value of a liturgy. It means we don't have to invent the wheel every single week. It means that Scripture's preserved. I have to say that what I've noticed, around our diocese and our blokes, I just love them, and they're terrific guys. But so often the thing that's gone are the opening verses of Scripture and the opening exhortation in morning prayer. And it's replaced by something else, which A, is longer in the end, and B, is never as good. Never as good. Very subjective, usually. The challenge, I think, in this is, this has been one of the strengths. I've seen it happening. As you'll know, Moore College is often criticised for the Broughton, the Knox-Robinson view of church. And one of the things that Dr. Knox used to emphasise was fellowship. Now, he was reacting against the church board that said 11 a.m. divine worship. And rightly so. Worships all the time. And those of you who knew Broughton Knox knew that he was a man of deep piety, personal prayer, and so fellowship wasn't the only aspect for him. But that's what all of us heard. And that's the way it's gone. And since we've focused on fellowship, it seems to me what's happening in evangelical churches, and probably charismatic churches as well, is that we expect far too much from each other and far too little from God. And so you get people come to church, and people have bent over backwards to welcome them. Oh, it doesn't meet my needs, And I wonder if we've dug that grave for ourselves by having such an emphasis at this level that we've lost this level. And the other thing, of course, is that people can't survive without the fellowship. When at the end of the day, surely we ought to be able to survive just with our fellowship with God, and the rest is bonus. Yeah, when you've got good fellowship. So I think that's a challenge, and I think that's but there are opportunities in that, I think, that we have as Anglicans. I reckon our local churches are worth working at. They're hard work. But I don't think there's anything really quite like it in terms of being able to provide opportunities both for fellowship, for teaching, and for outreach. Let me just share with you some of the encouraging signs that I've seen around Australia. I'm no expert in this, so I can only do it on the places that I've been able to observe. I think most people feel that the transformation in Armidale Diocese happened solely because of Chapo, and certainly he had a big part in it. But there were two other blokes, John Dow, and Frank Elliott. John Dow is still doing local sports, and still remembers the names of the people he ministered to 40 years ago. But he and Frank Elliott purposely went to Morpeth so that they could get into Armidale Diocese. And then, of course, there are others. Pete's dad, Pete Cheers, Ken, Pete Smart, the whole range of people. I just mentioned that was an important aspect. Canberra Goulburn, I think everybody was surprised to Stuart Robinson's election there. I think that partly there's two reasons. That one is I think a lot of evangelicals were prepared to go down to Canberra. George Browning actually invited quite significant numbers of them. They went. I think the other totally lost me. Gone from what I.
Why the diocese changed.
Why the diocese changed. But certainly there's been terrific encouragement down there. I'll remember the other point I was going to make later. And that's continuing to grow. Tasmania, of course, about 12 years ago, that too came right out of left field, and that was a wonderful answer to prayer for people like Peter Adkins and others like that who are the evangelicals down in that diocese. Adelaide, last year, I was asked to speak at the EFAC AGM in June or July, and I met 8 young men who had all gone to Bible College of South Australia. 4 had been ordained, and I think 4 had just been ordained. They had to go to finishing school, you know, at the Adelaide College of Divinity. But it was an extraordinary... I mean, I would never have dreamed of that 30 years ago when we were in Adelaide. It was just absolutely remarkable. I think part of that's got to do with them being fellas, the candidates. I think part of it's got to do with the fact that they commended themselves to the Archbishop. And then, of course, to hear of Tim Harris being appointed as the Assistant Bishop was just... You would never have dreamt that would have been possible 25 years ago. Brisbane's still a tough place for evangelicals. However, Mark Calder, many of you know Mark, he was Rector of Riseville for a number of years, 18 years. He's the Rector of Noosa, as he says, somebody had to do it. but you know the reason, from a human point of view, one of the reasons he got the nod there was that he and his family for the previous 12 years had gone on holidays to Noosa. And instead of going to the Baptist, they went to the Noosa Anglicans. So they were known. It's a very simple little thing, but they were actually known there. And I'm quite sure the other factor, I'd get phone calls from parish nominators reasonably regularly from non-evangelical parishes asking me to suggest names to people. The lay people understand the issues and understand what they want clearer, I think, than anybody else. And so I can just imagine the situation, putting up his name and the people saying, well, he's part of us. He's come 3 times every year for the last 12 years, which is as regular as something. Newcastle's encouraging. There's some SMBC men who have been ordained in the last 2 or 3 years in Newcastle Diocese. Arthur Copeman, who's been at Kincumber for 18 or 19 years. Arthur is about 12 months ago was asked by the bishop to pioneer a church plant in the middle of Newcastle Evangelical Anglican Church. And they met for 6 months for prayer and just gathering a team, and that's now going, and going very well. And that's with the Archbishop's goodwill, or the Bishop's goodwill and approval. So there are some real encouragements around the traps. It's hard work, but there have been some real encouragements. Let me share with you some challenges to us as evangelicals that I've observed, and I want to head this up called Beware of Our Strengths. Beware of Our Strengths. Just so that you understand where I still stand, I believe, along with Jim Packer, that the evangelical conservative reform position is about as clear a clear position as you can possibly have, most satisfying, worth preaching, worth living for, okay? But one of the things is that the joys that brings can bring some problems to us. First one is the term gospel ministry and gospel ministers. My personal view is that I believe it's an unhelpful terminology. I'm a minister of the gospel of the Lord Jesus. I'm not a minister of the gospel. You see where I'm going? Gospel is a descriptor of what we're on about. The word gospel, of course, was a secular word, just borrowed, of course, too, because of the gospel was great news, good news, great news. I tell you why I think it's unhelpful, because what it does is helps us to be satisfied if we're clear on the gospel. rather than being clear on our commitment and our relationship to Christ, of whom the gospel is the means of us entering into. It's only a small thing, but of the 18th century revival petered out after 100 years, and one of the reasons was deism, the absent creator, as distinct from theism, which of course is an involved creator. And I just wonder if it's easy for us, and I think I've seen a few little signs of it, of myself and my evangelical brothers being very clear, for example, on the resurrection of Christ, as we ought to be, but not that clear on the abiding presence of the living Christ in our hearts and in our lives. That's my concern. So our strength in being clear in the gospel's content can keep us from knowing the gospel's God. And if Harry Goodhue is right that we're ploughing concrete, it seems to me that we've got to be very clear on the love of Christ, not only as a doctrine which we believe, but as an experience which we know, and on the indwelling power of the Holy Spirit to actually help us keep at it day by day, year by year. The second one is our theology of bishops. Now, those of you who are older did THL have no idea what happens in BTH and MDivs and all that kind of stuff, but do you remember that little question which we all boned up on in Doctrine 2, I think it was, write a short note on Essie, Benny Essie, Plenty Essie. Do you remember that? Can somebody tell me what it was? It was about the episcopy, wasn't it? Essie, of course, is the Roman Catholic position, absolutely essential. Plenty Essie, the Anglo-Catholic position of the full essence, and Benny, the evangelical position. Beneficial. Beneficial, if you got a good one. Beneficial. It's okay. Now, it's that doctrine that's actually helped evangelicals for centuries survive in non-evangelical dioceses. But it's that doctrine that's made it possible for it, for not just us, but for people all around the church. Yes, we'll respect the office of a bishop, we'll respect the person, but it's not essential. It's not the only way of ordering the church. Now, what's the weakness of that? That's the strength, is that it's sustained us. But, of course, the weakness of it is that we can so easily overlook, be discourteous, and that kind of stuff to bishops. Now, I'm not saying this just simply because I've been a bishop, but Woody Allen is right. His theology, 80% of life is just about turning up. Would you agree with that? I mean, you'd like your people to turn up 80% of the time, wouldn't you? 80% of life is just about turning up. Let me encourage us as evangelicals to recognise that the bishop still has responsibility, and we're wise to turn up. And we're wise to turn up not only because he has responsibility and influence, and if we want to make progress, we need to recognise that. But he is a man as well, or a woman as well, who needs encouragement. And I can still remember Marcus Sloan saying to me on the 25th of May 1981, in at the cathedral, at the consecration of Peter Carman. I said, what are we going to be? He already had his views on the resurrection. What do we do? And his answer to me was, Peter, two things. He's responsible for his patch. You're responsible for yours. Get on with it. If you have opportunity to speak up, but only on the issues that really matter. It's psychologically impossible to fight every battle. But to turn up, can I urge you, brothers, to turn up for Tom's ordination, for example, and to turn up robed, if that's what's expected, and to turn up robed well, in other words, be part of it, you know, and be keen to be part of it. That kind of turning up, I reckon, is the kind of thing and that will actually win the evangelical gospel a lot of credence. Simply because that means a lot to bishops. They are people and they have influence anyway. and we'd be silly not to capitalise on that kind of opportunity that we have. Third one, preaching does not stand alone. Preaching's good. Please hear me saying that. Preaching's good. But I want to suggest to you, I don't think it's primary. Prayer has got to come before preaching. I think it's absolutely essential that preaching is done well, thoughtfully, and well prepared, and is worth working at. I see amongst my fellow evangelicals such a desire to prepare their sermons that they forget to do other things that are part of the brief, like pastoring people. Remember house to house, that's what Paul did, Acts 20:20, publicly and from house to house. Remember where pastor teaches, Ephesians 4:12, we pastor by teaching, we teach through pastoring. The only criticism I heard of our Armidale clergy, the only consistent criticism, there are so few, it was a dream from that perspective in terms of my work, was they seem to spend a lot of time behind their computer and they don't seem to be visiting. I think the challenge for pastors is to win the battle of the thresholds out of our study into their homes. Now, I know all the arguments why people use against it, but I can't see how one can exercise a ministry without visiting. Let me remind you, it's biblical, Acts 20:20. It's father-like, the Father's house. It's Christ-like, the incarnation. It's spirit-like, paraclete means to draw alongside. Remember, it's used of a tugboat, drawing alongside of a larger boat. And it's exegetical. Some blokes say to me, Peter, how long should we prepare our sermons for? And a lot of guys have been told 20 hours. I said, well, 20 hours if you like, 8 in your study, 12 in people's lounge rooms. You've got 2 books to exegete. It's exegetical. And then finally, just 2 more. Grace is for works. I've noticed this in myself. Ephesians 2:10 follows Ephesians 8:9. That's not rocket science, is it? But you know Ephesians 2:10, don't you? We're God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works. The strength, of course, in our preaching on justification by faith is the most wonderful doctrine. There's nothing like it. Nothing like it in terms of our relationship with God and our self-care and a whole range of other things. Luther's writes the article of a standing or falling church, and I know why we have to emphasise it, because there's an endemic self-righteousness in all of us. It can easily slip from faith to works so easily. But the weakness, of course, is that we so love to rest and to take it easy. But why do we have erratic church attendances, I wonder? Why do we find it hard to recruit people for more than 4 weeks at a time? Say to Sunday school or the youth ministry or to something else. Why is it that we so easily confuse discipline, say discipline reading the Bible, people say, oh no, it's legalism. Is it because we have failed to preach that justification by faith is always for works, always for ministry, always for godliness? So it raises a question. And then finally, has our love of truth robbed us of our unity and our strength? Seems to have gone. Stephen Neal wrote in 1958 in Anglicanism. I've lost the quote. That the evangelicals never seem to have become a party in the Anglican Church, and it's unlikely that they ever will because of the inveterate habit of biting and devouring each other over minute issues. Now, once again, do not hear me saying anything other than truth matters. But I think the challenge has always been for us evangelicals is to be gracious in our differing with others, especially others who are evangelicals. I've observed that there are many people who would not call themselves evangelicals or who would be happy to call themselves liberals who were once evangelicals today. And my theory on it is that we all need friends. And often I wonder if it's been because we've been too tough on a particular issue with that particular person who found friends elsewhere. And I guess that's a terrific challenge to us. Piper's essay on John Newton. John Newton's a classic evangelical pastor, it seems to me. And it is really worth reading on that. I think of Philippians 1, for example, 15 to 18, is the most remarkable psychology in the New Testament. You know, when Paul's rubbished by his fellow Christians, these weren't false teachers, but they were impugning his motives. And Paul's in prison. He says, well, I don't care, so long as the gospel's preached. I find that extraordinary. I have to say to you that the hardest thing for me in parish ministry was not somebody moving back to Sydney or moving to Melbourne or moving to Albany, but it was somebody who moved from us.
Albany,
thanks, Brian. But it was somebody who moved to the next church. That was always the hardest. And yet Paul was just able to handle it. We have a classic illustration of that amongst us, I reckon, in Dave Second. You know, when the big split at Shepton Park happened. And what did Dave do? He just went to the Archbishop and said, Leaderville's vacant. Why don't you let them go off down there? And that was brilliant. Now we've got another evangelical parish. It was just a brilliant exercise of truth matters, but grace. It's truth and grace. So, brothers, they're just a few things. It seems to me that challenges, of course, are just simply opportunities. They've always been around. I think our forebears had them, and I think we have them. I hope, in some ways, they're helpful. It seems to me they are always ways of helping us to keep our focus on God, to be content where we are, to be content with His approval alone, pray to Him, and be confident in the gospel. Nothing less, nothing more. Thanks, Pete.
Questions?
The question is, could I comment on the growth in some of the other dioceses and evangelical ministries? Certainly in Canberra, I think there was, you know, there's been a strong lay influence right through. I don't know why it's happened in Adelaide, except obviously the Archbishop's been prepared to do that, to welcome those candidates. Certainly EFAC down there has a fairly large, I think there are two states where EFAC has a large lay rep. One is Melbourne by a long way, and Adelaide's been there, has been the other place. I can't really answer why it's happened, except that obviously the Archbishop of Adelaide has been prepared to welcome those candidates. Yeah.
Adelaide, there's been three or four of those blokes, school chaplains.
Yep, okay. Well, as you know, Trinity's like a denomination in itself. You know, in Adelaide, what is it, three? South? I think there's at least three other Trinity congregations. And in a sense, one might have thought that made it harder. But it obviously hasn't, you know, in that context. And I guess it may well be the fact that the Trinity congregations have grown, that, and I suspect this might be the case in Newcastle. As you know, there's the big independent evangelical churches in the southern part of Newcastle Diocese. I think perhaps part of it has said, well, we should be doing it as well. So perhaps that has commended those candidates. And obviously, I think they've kept the lines open, although there's been no major agreement between the Archbishop of Adelaide and the Rector of Holy Trinity, you know, in terms of what's been happening. There's at least been good dialogue, you know, taking place between them, and I suspect, you know, that may well have helped. I suspect a lot of it's got to do with availability. You know, and these guys have put up their hands and been prepared to... I'm optimistic about the evangelical cause. Truly, I think if we can just keep producing men and women who are keen to minister, who are able to minister, who are prepared to work in the system, that they'll be accepted in time. I mean, there'll be hiccups. The question has to do with what's likely to happen in the Anglican Church in terms of the leadership, in terms of some of these bigger issues, the sexual issues. But I don't know. The bishops are meeting this very day, or this very few days. And part of me had a little pang of thought, it might have been nice to have been there, because that same-sex thing will probably be coming up. But there will surely be others will be speaking for it. I honestly don't know. I think most of us have made the decision to work in a structure because we believe that the articles in the prayer book and our formularies are sound, and we're not the ones who have diverged from that others have. Now, what would happen if the General Synod brought in a motion that passed same-sex marriage? I don't know. I don't know. To be perfectly honest with you, one of the reasons I went to GAFCON was there was no way in the world I was not to GAFCON, to Lambeth. There's no way I was going to sit on the sidelines and not argue the case. But if it happened, I really don't know. But I guess I've lived through things just as bad. Had I known that, I probably would have gone to the bishops' conference. That saddens me because, I mean, that fits in exactly with one of the scenarios I was mentioning earlier in terms of that brother who's the bishop. That's what happened here, and that's why some of us moved that motion on sexuality, you know, way back, you know, with the private McAuliffe, his name was, wasn't it? The private ordination in the Archbishop's Chapel. Yeah, it was. But you're absolutely right. That's the way it will happen. And I guess the tragedy with Gippsland is it used to have strong evangelical convictions in that diocese. That's how Ridley College started. The bishop of Gippsland and one of the others went down and hired a boarding house, you know, in Melbourne. The stealth principle. I think we just, we must speak up, you know, and synod's one place to do it, person to person, church papers is another. Will it come in? I think Ben's question is, what do we do if it comes in officially? If it doesn't come in officially, I can handle that easier if I'm a parish minister. If it doesn't come in officially, I just get on and do what I've always done. I've got control of my pulpit, etc., etc. It becomes an embarrassment, of course, when you're trying to win people, when they learn about it. If it comes in from the top, then I suspect that's the time for most of the Anglican Church in Australia to leave. And the numbers are with evangelicals. Sorry. Oh, indeed. Yeah, and I have no doubt that the rector of Shenton Park will probably have a couple of people fronting up for marriage if it is brought in legally. No, they won't. They'll know what will happen there. they'll come to you or one of the others as a trespass, and that's where the issues will come. Laurie's asking if this happens, there's got to be a support system, and I think the answer is obviously yes. I think most of us have survived as evangelists. Most of you guys, myself, my method of survival was get on with it where I was, nurture the fellowship at this level and really value it and do all I could do to, you know, put input into it, and I'll certainly receive from it. Now, sometimes we had criticisms of that from brothers who said we've got to be more political, etc. But I think most of us just were expending ourselves in doing what we thought was absolutely vital, which was ground level. But you're absolutely right. If something like that did happen, either homosexual issue or over somebody speaking out about Islam, for example, and that kind of thing, then we really that's when we really have to gather around. We have to support each other, because it might be nice if it happens.
And there are lots of examples overseas already. I mean, you can go to Canada and you can see how they're restructuring around these sorts of issues. And if you think your congregation's going to go with you around these issues, you're probably going to be a very great surprise.
Yeah.
An acquaintance from Canada found that about a congregation of 200 people, about 50 people came with to start a new community. In North America at the moment, the Episcopalian Church is just schisming all over the place, like in all manner of ways to reform and restructure, mainly around buildings and all that sort of stuff, and some people are going. So it's kind of like an opportunity. It's actually an opportunity. You said right at the end there, she said, all the challenges are just new opportunities. Mm. And I guess it will form new opportunities for us. And we'll all make decisions at different points as well, won't we? Mm. We'll be able to put up with so much and no more on a personal level.
Temperament's got a big thing to do with it, I think. But yeah. Your comment, I've been astounded around Armidale, you know, and I'm not talking here about fringe people, I'm talking here about core congregational members who have been very, very shaky on the homosexual thing. Because they've all got nephews or, you know, sons of friends, and they're lovely people, etc., etc. And that's a big, just as when, you know, I always say to people, the test of universalism is when a loved one dies who's not a Christian. The test of biblical ethics is on this very issue.
And all our kids, my kids are being brought up in schools now, yeah, where tolerance is the great virtue it's taught.
Yeah.
And it's taught, yeah, much better than our sermons teaching this.
So Laurie's comment about support is absolutely vital. There's no doubt about that. You don't so much mean the government decision, you mean if there was an Anglican Church decision. Brother, I think the only... Well, there's two things. One is there'd be massive discouragement on the part of our lay people. And my little one-liner has been, when does the light shine the brightest? It's when it's the darkest. There's the opportunity again. You know, to prepare our brothers and sisters to be godly in their marriages. That's one thing. But secondly, I think we can only do it by helping people to see not only are essential doctrines important, but there are some ethical implications of the doctrines which are absolutely vital and are good for us as individuals and good for our community. I think we need to keep on reminding people that homosexuality as a practice is bad news. You know, I just heard it on the radio this morning, you know, about what's going on in England. And, you know, and Bob Catter's party. You know, I've just put out a video, an advertisement on homosexuality, and, you know, they've got the usual line. Why don't they stick to the big issues of health and safety? And I thought to myself, this is a health issue. You know, it's to help people to see that these are big issues. So, brother, I think it's... I don't know if there's a great deal of mileage in saying to our congregations, you know, look, the Anglican Church might go down the track in this direction. I think that could probably become counterproductive in the end. I think just big doses of the truth is... Charlie's just raised a question about the power of the clergy. I can just encourage you on this one. Is for clergy, it's the lay people who we ought to be getting to talk about these issues, to go and see the bishops if there's talk about, you know, these issues coming in. You know, and to go and to write letters, courteous letters. You know, they expect it from Kanishka, they expect it from Ken and people like that. But when they get them, you know that the lay people pay the bills. And the lay people are the key members. Build up the lay people. It's okay. Sorry, I've talked too long.
Can I just, on behalf of you all, thank Peter for taking time to pray and to prepare. And we look forward to your ministry to us over the next period of our life together.